The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in session and pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning, be seated, please. First case in our calendar is 98-1927, Joan Madera v. Satellite Shelters, Inc. Mr. Campbell.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Robert Campbell on behalf of Joan Madera. I would like to reserve about 5 minutes of my time. This case is going to provide very important guidance for appeals courts throughout the state in reviewing jury verdicts and post-trial motions regarding Ohio's law against sexual harassment. In the arguments that you will hear this morning, the most important law that will be cited is Ohio Revised Code 41.12.08 states in part that this chapter shall be construed liberally for the accomplishment of its purposes. The purposes of Chapter 41.12 of the Revised Code, Protection of Civil Rights of Citizens of the State of Ohio, and importantly in this case, civil rights of employees, and as this court has stated, the advancement of Ohio's strong public policy against workplace-based sexual harassment. A liberal construction of Chapter 41.12 requires appellate courts to place extra faith in the decisions of juries and trial courts and exercise extreme caution in reversing jury verdicts and reversing trial court's decision to deny motions for direct verdict, motions for judgment notwithstanding the verdict, and motions to new trial. There are three basic errors in the holding of the 8th District Court of Appeals in this case. The first is that the 8th District placed an extra burden on Mrs. Madera to establish that the inappropriate comments, the harassment in this case, was based on the harasser's sexual desire. The court wrote that, quote, put simply, none of the claimed harassment was predicated upon sexual conduct and or relations. The court also, earlier in this opinion, stated that it would apply, and stated that among the elements that Mrs. Madera would have to establish is that she was subjected to unwelcome sexual advances or requests for sexual favors, and that her refusal to submit to her supervisor's sexual demands resulted in a tangible job detriment. This test excludes, by definition, all claims based on gender, all claims based on pregnancy and its related conditions, because those clearly would not be motivated by sexual desire or sexual motivation by the harassment.
Even if this court were to agree with you, counsel, that definition is too narrow, and that gender comments that specifically have to do with gender sorts of things would suffice. Is your client also... I guess the 8th District found several other bases for saying that this verdict should be overturned, and one was that this workplace environment was not so permeated with this sort of conduct that it amounted to a basis for finding a constructive discharge. So, I mean, is this court we must look and take any of these alternative bases if they suffice to support the judgment of the Court of Appeals?
Well, clearly the Court of Appeals stated that in its opinion it was not a severe pervasive environment of any type, and assuming for argument gender-based harassment. However, again, the court took rulings of other courts and restricted it to such a degree that it would be difficult for any claimant to meet that. The courts have
you think here. that standard also is too
well, not the standard, narrow. But the application of the standard.
Okay.
The courts have routinely said that, you know, these sexual harassment laws are not to be a general civility code, not to purge the workplace of all workplace vulgarity. And what the court is talking about there is the profane, the occasional dirty joke, the boss that has a foul mouth, and the oversensitive employee who sues because she does not like to hear the F-word.
Or even legitimately sensitive. But it seems like the cases don't address hurt feelings,
well,
particularly.
But the difference here is this is not a situation where Mrs. Madera had to overhear the vulgar or the profane. These comments were directed to her because she was a woman, because, in her words, she was pregnant at her age, because of the conditions that resulted from her pregnancy and the effect that her pregnancy was having on her supervisor's ability to make money. The United States Supreme Court recently indicated the concern that you're talking about when it said that these laws are not meant to filter out the claims of sporadic use of abusive language, gender-related jokes, or occasional teasing. The testimony in this case, this is something that happens on a weekly basis, the reminders that you women want to have men's jobs, but you don't want to do the work. You're pregnant and choose to work, do the work.
Was she the only one that was receiving this type of treatment?
Yes, she was. There were some satellite branches throughout Ohio, and in that particular branch, there were two other female employees there, or two female employees there, including Mrs. Madera. She was the only sales representative.
She was the only one who was pregnant?
She was the only one who was pregnant, and she was also the only one in a position that you could state was not a traditional female role. The other female employee there was a secretary, and frankly, if we're dealing with someone who is hostile towards women in the workplace, she's in a position where it's difficult to even say, but she belonged. So
you can't say
for only directed to Mrs. Madera.
You can't say this was a standard operating procedure because all pregnant women were treated alike. It's just because she was the only one, she was singled out for these comments.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, before we get to that, don't we have to meet the threshold issue of what the 8th District said and did in this case? When I went back and reviewed their opinion and then looked at the cases that they cite for the proposition of whether or not there can be sexual harassment in these kinds of situations, it seems to me every one of their cases, and they say they have to be based on some sort of request for sexual favors. The Tackage case, for instance, and the whole list that they cite in their opinion. So don't we have to get over the threshold question whether there has to be for a 4112, any 4112.02 all the way through 8 cause of action, does there have to be sexual favors involved, or can you just have straight harassment of women like this appeared to be?
The answer is we absolutely do not need the sexual motivation, and it can be strict gender-based harassment.
Isn't that what RC 4112.02A provides for?
Well, it turns on the definition of what the word sex is, and unfortunately,
it's gender. They could have exchanged it for gender.
Easily exchangeable, and frankly, would have been better for all of us had they written that word.
Yeah, I understand what your position is, and I may very well agree with that. My concern is, you could never win one of these cases in the 8th District, could you?
Absolutely.
All right, that's my issue. You could, because
absolutely.
They say there has to be sexual favors involved. Every one of their cases say that.
They do.
Okay. And our question is, does that, is that the criteria, or can there be other sex discrimination, gender discrimination?
To give meaning to the statute, and under liberal construction, there has to be. The United States Supreme Court, the Onkyo case, said that sexual motivation is not relevant, and that a case can be made based on the harasser's general hostility to the presence of women in the workplace. And in fact, in the example, they refer to a woman supervisor having that hostility towards the presence of women in the workplace. Secondly, Revised Code 4112.01b expands on the word sex in 4112.02 and says that sex means pregnancy and pregnancy-related conditions. And even though there was larger tones of just an animosity towards the gender in this case, the pregnancy was extremely important because none of this started until Mrs. Madera became pregnant. One of the most and court appeals, I believe, misinterpreted the record in this with some help from appellants. Clearly, there was an incident testified to that Mrs. Madera was pregnant and cleaning out a trailer that had an offensive odor, and she was told when she asked for relief from that condition, if you're pregnant, choose to work, do the work.
So that brings me right back to the point. Now you're saying pregnancy is sex.
Absolutely.
Pregnancy is sex. Does it even have to be? Would she even had to be pregnant? What if she was just plain harassed, gender harassed, on the basis that she's a woman?
That's sufficient too, Your Honor. And the United States Supreme Court has said that, and certainly 4112.02 would not give the same protections to women that it gave to racial minorities, religious minorities, people from other countries.
You say it doesn't give that protection?
It wouldn't if it was given the 8th District's interpretation.
Well, to be fair, the 8th District, I read the 8th District opinion a little differently, I guess. After saying there's no sexual harassment in this case, that is not to say that gender-based comments cannot rise to the level of sexual harassment. And they comment, of course, on the fact that you look to see first whether there is the absence of the overt sexual harassment, which that's much easier, obviously, than to prove than this case is, and then go on to go through the various the tests that are necessary. I guess I don't see that. I'm not sure this makes any difference, but I don't see the 8th District saying you have to have sexual harassment to recover. They don't say that at all.
They say on page 10, in order to recover on a claim for sexual harassment in the workplace, the employee seeking recovery must demonstrate five elements, and element number four, the employee's submission to the unwelcomed advances was an express or implied condition for receiving job benefits, or the employee's refusal to submit to the supervisor's sexual demands, one of the conditions.
Well, we won't argue this, but I read words on page 15 of their appendix, or where they clearly say that it doesn't have to be sexual harassment. But I thought the legal or and a legal issue in this case, which is one reason I voted to bring it in, is this issue of whether the standard is a reasonable woman or reasonable person standard. What's your strongest argument for urging us to adopt the reasonable woman standard? Is there a difference?
I guess in a perfect world there's not a difference, Your Honor, but as another court noted, if we just say a reasonable person, we run the risk of confirming and making law the pervasive stereotypes of the community. And that is not what this is trying to do. Well, the question is, would a person in, and maybe reasonable woman is a too strong way to put it, I don't know that, but would a person in the employee's position, whether it is a reasonable woman, whether it is a reasonable African American, whether it is a reasonable Italian American pervasive, hostile environment, and in this case had no choice but
if the harassment went the other way, a woman supervisor who engaged in sexual harassment or whatever of a male, would we then say it's a reasonable male standard, or how would we apply?
I think we have to. I think we need to look at what a reasonable employee, and maybe that's the better phrase, the reasonable employee.
Rather than using the gender.
Rather than the gender. And ultimately, that's what this comes down to, is who's going to make that determination of what a reasonable employee would think was unacceptable.
The reason that the reasonable woman standard came to being, and it was developed first in the Sixth Circuit. And because of the fact that historically the reasonable person standard has been based upon the views of a male, and a male looking at these situations are not affected in the same way as a woman is. And so that's why the reasonable woman standard was developed. And perhaps the reasonable woman standard should be, since you've mentioned African American and everyone else coming from different backgrounds, perhaps it should be a reasonable employee standard in these situations rather than but taking it from the perspective of the person who is being allegedly discriminated against.
Thank you, Your Honor. I see my time is up. We would ask that the court reverse the decision.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Mr. Merkovich.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court.
Excuse me.
It's Merkovich.
Merkovich.
Ohio law defines harassment in its administrative code that unwelcome sexual advances, requests for sexual favors, and other verbal or physical conduct of a sexual nature. And in a hostile environment case, it goes on to say, when such conduct has the purpose or effect of unreasonably interfering with an individual's work performance or creating an intimidating, hostile, or offensive working environment, the conduct must be severe, pervasive, and have an impact on the work environment. Looking at the record as a whole in this case, as in fact the Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit did, or Eighth District did, the totality of the circumstances make clear that there is, in fact, no basis for liability. In fact, there is no case from Ohio or any place in the country that imposes liability on an employer or individual based on a record of this kind. None has been cited to by the plaintiffs or the amicus, nor can they. This is simply one of those cases where justice requires that the jury verdict be reversed and the Court of Appeals' well-reasoned decision affirmed. The court, in one of its questions, referred to the standard formulation used, frankly, by all courts, federal and state, since the Henson case came up in the 11th Circuit in the early 90s. And that does, in fact, refer to the standard five elements of sexual harassment case. The person must establish that he or she is part of a protected group, subjected to unwelcome sexual harassment based on sex, affecting a term, condition, or privilege of employment, and that respondent's superior liability exists.
Well, let's explore that. So is it your view, in response to the line of question of Justice Douglas before, that if there's no sexual favor by the one, but just total gender and pervasive, ongoing, intolerable, there's still no sexual favor.
That's actually two issues. One is that can and might be sex discrimination as opposed to sexual harassment. Secondly,
it could be what?
Sex discrimination or discrimination in the terms and conditions of employment based on sex. I think part of the issue, and that's really what I was trying to get to, is that the Court of Appeals is dealing with two themes of law. One is the sex discrimination-based theme, another is the sexual harassment-based theme. The standard recited by the court in its boilerplate introduction refers to the standard formulation for a sexual harassment case. I think the Ohio Administrative Code frankly quotes the very same standard when it says it has to be unlawful conduct of a sexual nature. But when it went into the analysis of applying these facts and to the law in this case, the Court of Appeals correctly looked at the overall law and said, look, gender-based animus can in fact give rise to a claim based on a hostile work environment. The issue of whether we call it sex harassment or sex discrimination is probably something that law review articles could be written about. But in the real world, in that jury box, in the courtroom, it has to be of a level of conduct that is severe and pervasive enough to interfere with the work environment. And that's, I think, what the Court of Appeals did here. And I think that the Chief Justice referred to the sentence that I think shows the Court of Appeals did look at it when they said that is not to say that gender-based comments cannot rise to the level of sexual harassment. That's coming back and saying, we understand that there can be gender-based comment that is, in fact, sufficiently pervasive and severe to amount that way.
But that should have said sexual discrimination, as opposed to sexual harassment, given your two definitions.
I believe, Your Honor, that that's where the confusion comes in this area. And I think if you look at the administrative code in Ohio, it clearly says sexual nature, sexual advances. This is not something that the circuit court in the Cleveland area was making up. This is something that's written down, and in fact, it is the standard formulation used around the country.
But for harassment?
For harassment.
All right. Now, are the elements different for discrimination?
I believe the only difference would be it could be gender-based comments, but it would still, in order to qualify, have to have a definite impact on the job condition, what we would call a quid pro quo case, or to be a hostile environment case. It would, in fact, need to do more, and it would have to somehow rise to the level of interfering with the person's work performance. I know, too, that the Court of Appeals at page 18 of the
special a comment that you're so factors that look like you're pregnant. It wouldn't take very many of those to for a reasonable person to find the workplace intolerable. I mean, that
Your Honor,
a pretty insightful
comment. Your Honor, it is certainly not the kind of comment that we would instruct our children, for example, to make. But putting things in context, and I think the trial transcript here.
But does that fit into harassment or does that fit into discrimination or
that's a difference.
Is that not gender-based at all? Is that
another
common bias?
Your Honor, it's the kind of comment that could be made to a man or a woman. I understand that only a woman can become pregnant, but is your preference that you look like you're pregnant? Could it be said to a male or a female? Is it a way we would choose people to have people not know? But let me point out that at the time this comment was made, Ms. Madera had a surgical hernia that visibly protruded. Mr. Boyash denied making that. He lost that at trial. I understand that issue. Having said that one comment, I believe if you look at the case law, the Black versus Aaron case out of Ohio in the Sixth Circuit, the comments that are required to make an environment severely and pervasively intimidating require many of those comments on a regular and persistent basis, not one or two. Mrs. Madera identified
well, is that really the way we should measure this? I mean, should we take another look at that? And it seems to me we all do it. We're all insensitive to other people in various ways. Sometimes we don't mean to be. Some comments can be uttered again and again, and they're not really all that hurtful. They can almost be in the kidding range. And other comments made once or twice can be so abusive. Wouldn't you have to also weigh the nature of the comments? And isn't that what juries are for?
In part, yes, that is what juries are for, but in part, the reason the system has grown up to review jury findings and to instruct juries and to examine that record is because juries don't always get it right. And because juries sometimes get it wrong, it's up to the court system and the judges to look at that record. And that's what the Court of Appeals did. And they looked and they saw 7 comments over 2 years. They saw a woman with 8 months of paid leave and 24 months of employment. They saw a supervisor who every time he had an objective decision to make about her, should she be paid full-time even though she's working part-time? Answer, yes. She comes back from a leave. What job should she be paid? She gets a merit increase at the maximum range at the time. Those are things that objectively call it the workplace. I think what the Court of Appeals said is you have to look at the totality of the circumstances and make that determination. And again, we come back to the notion that was it appropriate for Mr. Boydosh in a social setting to comment on Mrs. Madera's weight? No. But it was a comment on her weight, is what it was. It was not something that was sexually harassing.
But the jury had all that, didn't they? I mean, they had the good and the bad. Obviously, there's much good in terms of.
The jury did, and basically in deliberations that lasted longer than the trial by a 6-2 vote with a 4-person dissenting, which was the first in my personal experience, they found in favor of the plaintiff. And that's why we're here today. But the Court of Appeals focused
on. I mean, that's how we get to it. It's just like
doing that.
Sometimes they all agree, and sometimes they don't.
Correct. And I would point out further that the Black versus Zarin case is in judgment, notwithstanding the verdict case. As is the Culligan versus Baskerville versus Culligan International. This is an area where courts regularly understand the need to come in and look at the evidence, because people in a jury box tend to look at it and say, do I like it or not like it sometimes, and not apply the correct legal standard. And that's why if you look around the country, when cases come in, whether it's in the Sixth Circuit in the Black versus Zarin matter, or whether it's in the Seventh Circuit with the Culligan matter, courts step in and say, this is not supported by the evidence here. And frankly, the Court of Appeals was kind when they looked at Mrs. Madera's trial testimony and described it as convoluted. Anyone reading that testimony will be left with the firm conclusion that no sexual harassment took place. And that's why we're here, and that's why we believe when you look at the evidence and you look at all three of the issues raised, not one of them is sufficient to overturn the Court of Appeals ruling. Because no matter what standard is applied, no matter what impact you look for, the fact remains there was not a severe and pervasive impact on the workplace. Mrs. Madera can identify only 7 specific comments. The one that was just referred to involving changing a trailer, I referred to the transcript site in our brief, but at the time of that comment, Mrs. Madera said she wasn't even sure she was pregnant. And she later testified that it was not harassment.
Okay, you keep using the word harassment again, and I thought we just established that this wasn't a harassment case.
Your Honor, I think what I tried to say is harassment has been construed to include discrimination, and I think that when you look at, historically, when you look at one formulation that comes from the pure harassment side, if you can look at that and say that doesn't permit gender-based comment.
Well, just looking at our Ohio law, the administrative code clearly, this is not a harassment case.
If you look at the Ohio Administrative Code, there's no way that you can define
okay.
this. If you respect that definition, this is not sexual harassment.
So then let's go to sexual or gender discrimination. It seems to me the strongest argument there is that it didn't affect the job performance. That's one of the criteria from the cases. Does not that reward the wrongdoer?
Judge, I think that...
I mean, here's somebody who said, okay, I continued, even though all this went on, I continued to do, they say, well, we didn't affect you. You did a good job the whole time we were harassing or discriminating against you. Why should she be penalized for doing a good job?
She's not being penalized for doing a good job. And the Court of Appeals was very clear in saying that. What the Court of Appeals did was look at the totality of the circumstances, and they said, one of the factors you look at in deciding whether this behavior has unreasonably interfered with a person's ability to work is whether the performance is impaired. If it's not, that is not the end of it. You could also look, for example, the psychological damage, psychological distress. None of that here. I mean, you can go through and you look at all the indicators that would suggest there was a performance problem. And you know, too, Your Honor, with all respect, that this Mrs. Madera never complained to Mr. Boydosh about his comment. She never complained to anyone with whom she was in frequent contact at Satellite Shelter's home office about these conduct. The U.S. Supreme Court has made very clear that in these cases, no matter what we're going to call them, if there's not a tangible job with them, that there has to be a complaint for there to be liability when there is, in fact, a policy prohibiting that bad behavior. And there was none of that here. And that's a further reason why you look at her performance in her work environment and what really needs to be there is some interference with her performance. It doesn't mean it has to have an impact on how she ultimately does it, but is there something here that interfered with her ability to get her work done? And frankly, coming back late from lunch and eating lunch at your desk and thereby extending your lunch hour, it's okay for a supervisor to be unhappy with someone doing that. That is perfectly acceptable. And he can get angry with that. Now, if he gets angry with that, why is it that the court system should interfere? Only if it interferes and has an impact on the job environment and the job in the workplace. With respect to the reasonable woman standard, let me read from the trial court's jury instructions. Because I don't believe, first of all, this issue is properly preserved at the trial court or court of appeals level. But secondly, the trial court at page 357 of the transcript instructed the jury in determining whether the comments were severe and pervasive, you must consider the evidence from the perspective of a reasonable person. That is, you must determine whether a reasonable person would have been offended by the conduct in question. In the Harris versus Forklift case, the U.S. Supreme Court addressed the issue of whether we should, as a nation, have the reasonable woman standard. It emphatically rejected both the Sixth and Ninth Circuit views and said, no, it's the standpoint of a reasonable person. And that is, in fact, where all the courts in the country have come down that have evaluated it since the Harris case. So with respect to all of these matters, where are supervisors and employees must be free to work together. They must be free to interact with each other and yet to make statements that are something other than what we would script for them if we had that magic pencil to tell them what to say and how to say it. And they have to be able to interact without fear of judicial retribution based on the general civility code. That's what the Farragher case said. The Ohio Revised Code and Administrative Code set forth appropriate limits. It's based on and consistent with federal law. It offers meaningful, predictable protection to women and men in the workplace. When the conduct is severe and pervasive, and it affects the work environment to the point it interferes with performance or creates a hostile and intimidating environment, then it's illegal. 7 comments over 2 years, 8 months of which are spent on paid leave of absence, with raises upon her return, is not in fact actionable. Borrowing from the various comments, it is clear to us that Joe Madera has not been sexually harassed or discriminated against. Whether it's the Black versus Zarin case or the Culkin International case may not matter. The courts, to quote the Minnesota Supreme Court, Justice Esther Tomljanovich, who became a lawyer at a time women were not hired by law. And the only job she could get was to be a reviser of statutes in the administrative office. The court simply cannot be the arbiter of all her feelings. It is important that we communicate our feelings to one another, but if we must live in fear that a lawsuit will result each time we make a comment or use a word that someone somewhere sometime might find offensive, all human exchange of words and ideas will cease, and our world will be a worse place to live in. We request that the court affirm the finding of the court.
Thank you. Mr. Campbell, you've used your time. You may take 30 seconds.
First, we can argue that all day. We've done that. We did that in July 1997 when this case was tried to a jury. This is why juries should be making these decisions. The United States Supreme Court says the full impact of gravity depends on a constellation of surrounding circumstances, expectations, and relationships which are not fully captured by a simple recitation of the words used for the act to perform. That's what a court of appeals has, simple recitation of the words used. A jury gets to see people, hear people, make judgments on credibility, make judgment on the genuineness of the people testifying. More importantly, the juries are the people who work and live in this community and should make these decisions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.